As you know, right now, the computer industry is in the tank. Personal computers, big computers, everything. And it's difficult. It's a difficult time. But I'm sure that Henry Ford had a few bad quarters back in the 1920s. And the automobile had a sort of historical imperative. The minute it was invented, a sequence of events had to happen. The same is true with the personal computer. There is a tremendous momentum behind this. And I think that this year may be a delay. This year we may look back and say, well, 1985 was a slow year. But there is such momentum behind this that it will happen. It will permeate and change forever our educational processes.
Hello, and welcome to CoolCast, the best 30-plus minute app conversation you're going to hear all week long. Oh, yeah. My name is Erfan Elijah, and I'm surrounded by greatness today. Lucky you guys. Joining me this episode, I can't read my own handwriting. He's the Cultimac editor-in-chief and the bar fight champion. Leander Caney is here.
Hello, Erfan. Ta-da-na,
Also joining us, he helps run Cult of Mac, and by help, I mean he does 98% of the work, while Leander, quote-unquote, rests his eyes in his lavishly padded office chair. Lewis Wallace is here with us. Hey, Lewis.
Hey, how's it going, Erfan?
Does anyone call you Lou? Can I call you Big Lou?
Actually, there's a Big Lou in my band, so no.
What's he look like? Is he cool?
She.
Oh. Hopefully she doesn't look like you.
That's right. Yeah, she dodged a bullet on that one.
They call him Luis Augustus.
They call her Luis, or they call
him
Luis?
They call Luis Luis Augustus at our local sandwich place.
Luis.
I do look very Hispanic, right?
Is it? It just sounds like a more feminine to me. And you're not a very feminine looking dude, so I think it's kind of a funny nickname. Lewis, what's your official title? I'm sorry, I have to keep asking you because I forgot. What do you actually do for Cultimac?
Managing editor.
Okay, so I was actually technically right in my description.
Juggler was not available. That was the
job
title I wanted.
Oh, well, Leander doesn't make you juggle for him ever to entertain him while he's eating his lunch.
I know, Lewis, I'm bored because there's some juggling.
Scene in Lord of the Rings where the steward is eating his lunch and he's like eating tomatoes and juices are squirting out of his mouth and he's like, Hobbit, sing something to me. That's not you?
No, but I have this really cute little jester outfit that I love to put on and dance around the office while Leander sleeps.
What a entertaining man you are. I had no idea. I want to see you do some of those dances. We should get Leander to record some and put some on YouTube.
All right, we will. We'll put them in the show notes. Well, Lewis, you were dancing the other day. Remember at the Jefferson Airplane?
Oh, my God. The hippie dance.
Lewis is doing some hippie dance.
Can you even dance at Jefferson Airplane? That's like dancing to Led Zeppelin.
Well, right. He was doing some weird hippie dance, right?
Dances in quotes.
Yeah. He was trying to show how awful it was, you know, like how antiquated they sound these days.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys sound like you have a pretty good time in the office.
Well, he did until he ruined Jefferson Airplane for me.
This sounds like a whole new YouTube web series that you guys need to start. This can be the most popular thing Cultimac does, actually, hearing you describe it. This is something I would definitely subscribe to.
Okay. All right. Good thinking. We need to expand.
All right. Well, let's see here. What do we have this episode? Oh, right. Yeah, we've got some good stuff this episode, everyone. We are going to be talking about some iPhone 8 rumors. And these are some odd ones. It has to do with the next iPhone not having Touch ID at all, period. And we'll talk about what it could have instead. Also, we're going to give some more examples of the cool stuff people are coming up with Apple's new AR kits framework that they're including in iOS 11. I'm seeing some incredible stuff that people are building and building quickly. And before we started the show, Leander was quick to tell me how lame my examples were and how cool his examples
much
were.
Much cooler.
So he's going to tell us about his really cool examples and take a big dump on the examples that I'm going to be providing. And then Leander is going to be telling us the story of slide to unlock. You remember that gesture we all used to use before Touch ID? There's a really cool story behind it, as you would imagine there is with a lot of the iPhone stuff. And Leander is releasing a new ebook, a hot new ebook, which if you listened to the show last week, we talked about, and we made it sound as though it were released, because we talked about it for about 30 minutes straight. And when I was going to look for the link to link to it in the show notes, I couldn't find it anywhere, and it took me about 20 minutes to realize Leander actually hasn't released it anywhere. There is no actual ebook yet. It's going to be coming out soon, which he neglected to tell us last episode.
Yes.
When he was talking about the ebook as though it existed presently. When is it actually coming out, Leander?
Like you said, soon, in quotes. Soon-ish. Soon. I said July, right? Because I don't want to make that mistake, that you know, like Apple's done a few times where they say you commit to a hard date. It's written, and it is, you know, we just need to lay it out and get a cover for it and get to all the processing, you know, like get it processed into an actual ebook. So,
because right now it's just words in my mind, you know, so no, it's done in my mind. I just have to actually type it all out and then edit it and format it and release it.
That was the state it was in last week. And this week it's actually a little more finished. So it's definitely, you know, it's a pages document now. So
okay.
It's getting closer.
It's in the process.
I'm confident it's getting better.
But you're releasing excerpts of it on the website, which I'll link to again this week. And if people go to one of the excerpts, you can sign up so that when the book does come out, you'll get emailed, and then you can get, because it's a free ebook, there's no reason not to sign up, right?
Right.
And then people can grab it once it hits the internet in the year 2062.
No, we'll have it done in a week or two. I mean, like, you know, 2 weeks at max, 1 week hopefully.
Okay, all right. Well, you heard it here first, folks. 2 weeks max, which I'm not sure I believe, but we'll see what happens. In the meantime, you can read the excerpt, which is on the website. Before we jump into this iPhone 8 news, let me go ahead and say a couple of thank yous. The first one to Shutterstock for supporting this episode. You might know Shutterstock is the home of royalty-free photos, but they offer so much more. Kickstart your next interactive project with video clips or music tracks from their collection. And if you make YouTube videos, you know, particularly music tracks that are not going to get you banned from YouTube, are very hard to find and are very important to your actual videos. So for all of your creative needs all in one place, head on over to shutterstock.com/cultcast. That's Shutterstock, shutterstock.com/cultcast. And you will get a 20% off discount for a limited time. Also want to thank Squarespace for supporting this episode. If you need a website, Squarespace is the place to go. They are continually updating their website offerings to make it even easier for you to build a beautiful website quickly, or an e-commerce website, or a blog, or a place to feature your artwork, or a place to feature your business. In the last 30 days, Squarespace has updated their analytics features. So they are designed to help you better understand your audience and drive more relevant traffic to your website and ultimately help your visitors take action on your website. Plus, they've also launched 16 new templates for you to choose from. And these are the templates that you can choose quickly and have a website up quickly, and they will look great on any device that visits. And now they support promotional pop-ups, which you can customize to include sales messages, discount codes, newsletter signups, and you can also adjust how those pop-ups appear so they're not annoying your readers when they hit your websites. Lots of powerful features always being added, and all this stuff is always included in your Squarespace subscription. You can get started with a 2-week free trial, build a website, see how you like it at squarespace.com. And if you want to continue your service at the end of the free trial, you can use code CULTCAST at checkout to save 10% off any order. And if you order a year of service, you get an additional discount plus a free domain name at squarespace.com. Okay, let's talk about iPhone 8. This is kind of a strange story to me. It came out this week that the next iPhone, the iPhone 8, may not have Touch ID at all. No Touch ID on the front and no Touch ID on the back. And this comes from Apple analyst Ming-Chi Kuo, who seems to be the only guy who gets anything right these right. days.
Yeah.
And whatever happened to Gene Muster, he totally disappeared, right? No one even talks about him anymore. He's probably covering Windows phones.
He went into venture capital, didn't he?
Did he?
Didn't he start? I think he started a firm, but he was posting some nonsense the other day that I saw. It was totally muddle-headed. Can't remember what it was, but yeah.
He'll always be one of my personal favorites. He may not have got very many things right, but he was sure good at using his imagination to dream things up, which I appreciated. He gave us stuff to talk about. Well, Ming-Chi Kuo said, we predict the OLED model, the iPhone 8, won't support fingerprint recognition. The reasons? Well, the full screen design doesn't work with the existing capacitive fingerprint Touch ID sensor. And the under-display fingerprint recognition tech still isn't ready. So, Louis, if we don't get Touch ID, what are we going to have in its stead? We got to have something, right?
Well, that's the, they keep talking about 3D facial scanning that, I don't know. To me, I find it hard to believe that they're going to get rid of Touch ID just because it's so baked into everything. And I mean, they just got it into the MacBook Pro, right? And I just don't see them turning their back on that. I could see 3D facial scanning augmenting it, existing alongside it. But to me, it just seems crazy. I mean, the same day that Kuo came out with that report, Bloomberg had a thing talking about basically the same thing, quoting people familiar with the product, anonymous sources. And it said the same thing. Apple's testing this 3D face scanning technology in prototypes. The point that they made was that it would be faster, easier, and more secure than Touch ID. And I guess the reason for, more secure is it's more data points, it's 3D, and, one of the problems with the whole using your face to unlock your phone in the past, it's been tricked by photographs and things like that. Nobody wants that to happen. So, the one thing I can say is Apple is not going to take a step backward. They're not going to unleash something that isn't as secure. I mean, that's one of the building blocks of the company. It's one of the things that they hold most dear to their heart. So
it's funny that the comment section of this story was just full of haters. Everyone was saying the exact same thing, that there's no way Apple is going to get rid of the Touch ID. And the only reason I would believe that they actually might is just because this is coming from Ming-Chi Kuo, who really is the only guy who ever gets anything right, and he has a really good track record, which makes me think, oh, well, shoot, maybe this is going to happen.
Yeah, he's the Apple whisperer.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of Android phones, right, with underscreen fingerprint detectors.
Uh-huh.
I think so. They're actually out there, and they've been showing demos for a couple of years. You know, like I just did a quick search, this has been demoed going back a couple of years. Going back a couple of years, so. I don't know. It looks as though the argument that it's not ready for prime time or it's not working, they're struggling to make it. That might be true, but
well, one of the other parts of this story that I thought was cool was the fact that it could read your face. The iPhone would be able to read your face even when you weren't standing like directly in front of it or have it pressed right up, into your face. Like you could be walking up towards it, and it might be able to just read your face as you were approaching it. Was my understanding of the story. And so then it can unlock itself that way. And the fact that they said it would be faster, I don't know if they meant faster than Touch ID or faster than other facial recognition software. That would be my question. Because it has to be faster than Touch ID. And the Touch ID on the new iPhones, the newer iPhones, I should say, are blazingly fast. I mean, you touch them and in a split second, they unlock your phone. Like all the old problems with Touch ID not working the first time or being slow, all those problems I feel like have been resolved, and now they've really perfected it. So it has to be better than what they already have. Still, all that said, I can't imagine them doing away with the Touch ID altogether and not at least having a sensor on the back of the phone. That just makes so much sense. Like if they can't get it working, why not just put a Touch ID sensor on the back of the phone? That way you have the option to unlock the phone without having your face be anywhere close to it, or how is it going to perform in the dark is another question that I have. Like, is it going to be able to read your face when it's pitch black in your room? Because I know you guys probably do this too. Like as soon as I wake up, this is such a bad habit. As soon as I wake up, I grab my phone, right? And I start reading it.
Sadly,
and,
yes.
My bedroom has blackout curtains, so you're not going to be able to see my face there. So I got to have another way to unlock my phone. So I still don't believe the fact that they're not going to have this, even though Ming-Chi Kuo is so reliable.
Well, and then he also threw in some stuff about iris or, you know, eye scanning too, right? It sounded a little bit like he's flinging a bunch of stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, and he did say that these were their predictions. So this is what he thinks is going to happen. I don't think that means that this is absolutely what's going to happen, because usually his analysis is more based upon what's happening in the supply chain, and he doesn't talk about his analysis in terms of predictions. I feel like he usually is more resolute in what he's saying, and this time he literally said, we predict the OLED iPhone will not have fingerprints recognition support. So it's like, oh, isn't another word for predict just guess? Right?
Right.
So maybe we shouldn't take this as seriously.
Well, there's been lots of reports about production problems. Like, you know, I was just looking back through our archive, and we've had lots of stories about they're having trouble with this, and they can't get it to work, and this is the big bottleneck, and it's holding up supplies, and blah, blah, blah. But it seems like the rumors are a bit all over the place, too, though. Like, it was, you know, rumored to be a sure thing, then it was rumored to be not a sure thing.
Yeah, and the same goes for the OLED displays. Will they have enough? Are they going to be able to produce as many as they need? So there's a lot of things up in the air with the iPhone 8. And also, are they going to call it the iPhone 8? Because we keep calling it that, but I don't know what they're going to call it. I can't imagine they're going to call it the iPhone 8, because why would they release the 7S and the 8 at the same time? That's kind of confusing, isn't it?
Yes.
Right.
Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about ARKit. This is the framework that is built into iOS 11, and it allows developers to quickly build augmented reality applications on your iPhone. And we've talked a little bit about this before, and I've seen some really cool examples pop up out there of what people have been able to do pretty quickly. One of our own listeners, Zeph McLaren, he tweeted me, and he had a Apple One in his office. So it looked like it was just sitting there. Not very useful, admittedly, but it was cool. I mean, it was cool, kind of a cool thing just to see. And people have those kinds of examples fairly often, where you just have something not really useful, but just cool sitting there in 3D space. But one of the other examples I saw, which was pretty useful, was this AR measuring tape. And it, if you guys haven't seen the video, I'll link to it in the show notes. And this thing kind of blew my mind a little bit in how useful it would be in real life. How often do you find yourself needing a measuring tape? I mean, I do all the time. I always need a measuring tape. I probably use one once a day. And you would be able to point the phone.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like to measure
keep
things.
Tabs on things, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I like to make sure things are the right length. And so you can point the phone at a spot on the wall or anywhere in 3D space. And then you can drag the phone, or I guess that's not the right word. You can move the phone and point it to another spot, and it will have a 3D measuring tape just floating there in space, and it was accurate. You can actually see the distance between two spots in 3D space.
Right.
That is super useful. Another maybe not so useful example, but a fun example, was everyone's jumping on the Minecraft, the augmented reality Minecraft train. I feel like this is going to become really popular in augmented reality ever since Microsoft showed that example with the HoloLens. This guy was building a Minecraft city, I guess, in 3D space, and he was going around and showing this stuff, like sitting on his floor, and he had the structure sitting on his kitchen table and stuff. And that may not sound useful to you, but I bet your kids would absolutely go bonkers over it, because Minecraft is like crack for kids. They love Minecraft. And being able to use your iPad or your phone to build those things in 3D space, I think would be really popular for kids. Leander, I know my examples are totally lame. What do you have? Well, what do you have are going to blow away my pretty awesome examples that I just gave?
Well, there was one that was posted up last week that was absolutely mind-blowing. It was like a portal to to another dimension.
Oh, yeah?
Did you see that
Shoot,
one?
Shoot, I didn't see that one.
It was it looked like a street in Europe, like an old town in Italy or Spain. And there's this portal, like a doorway, that you can see this completely different landscape through. and the guy is moving around, so you know you can get a different perspective through the portal.
Uh-huh.
And then he starts to walk into it, and he goes into this 3D world, and it's, you know, it's completely rendered, and so that was compelling enough. But then he turns around, and there's the doorway he's just walked through, and it's showing live video of the street that he's just walked in from.
Huh.
And it was like, whoa, that is incredible. That looks really astonishing. You know, like it was such a compelling illusion. You know, like he's moved from one world to another, like looking at, you know, of course he's looking at his phone or his iPad, but it really was compelling. It was mind-blowing, you know, like it's so realistic. And I think that's the thing. I've been following this Twitter account called Made with AR Kit. And it's, you know, all one word, so at Made with AR Kit on Twitter, and he's posting up a whole bunch of examples, and these are all just like, you know, proofs of concept and people playing around. There's a guy that had a recreation of the moon lander, mm-hmm. Landing on the moon in his kitchen, and that one was astonishing too. It was just like, was just jaw-dropping to see the little, you know, Apollo moon lander to come down onto this virtual moon, and he's moving around it and it's casting shadows. The realism is astonishing.
Huh.
And I was like a total AR. Like, I was like, oh, this is, you know, like, it's toys, it's games.
You were really lukewarm on it. Oh, you thought it was totally lame when it first came out.
I'm totally a believer now. Oh, my God. I really think, it, you know, like, they're right. It is utterly game-changing. It's like, it is an astonishing new platform. And I think, like, a good example is, like, someone showed, had made a proof of concept of shopping, like, on Amazon through AR. And they have this, you know, the goods you want to buy appear in photorealistic detail, you know, up on your kitchen table, and you can start swiping through and you can inspect them from all these different angles. Huh. I mean, it is so much better, right? You can see immediately and clearly that it is better than looking at pictures on the web, right? Because you've got, you know, photorealistic 3D representations of whatever you want to buy. And if it's like lipstick or, you know, some washing soap or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. You know, you can see what you're going to get. You can see its actual size, its actual, you know, and what it will feel and look like. This is going to, like, I think overnight become a big, big deal, a huge deal. And like Apple says, you know, like, they've got the world's biggest AR platform in the world, you know, already deployed.
Right.
Everyone's going to be able to get this. You know, they showed another one of some dishes at a restaurant, you know, so you could call up this virtual menu and see what the dishes look like in a restaurant. You know, I can totally see that. Like, so it's like the opposite, you know, like people take out their phone and they get an Instagram photo of what they're eating. You know, instead you'll sit down and get your phone out and you'll start looking, you know, like in the setting of the restaurant, like what you might be going to eat. So I can totally see how there's a whole bunch of the, you know, real world, useful real world examples, you know, that aren't games, that aren't trivial. Like I said, that measuring thing, it was so accurate. You know, you could call up IKEA furniture and you can stick it in your living room and you can totally see where it's going to go and if it will fit.
Well, like, I think the key point being if it will fit, because when we were talking about this story last week, I thought it was just to see how it looks. But you can actually see if the couch will fit between your dressers
with millimeter accuracy.
Yeah, yeah. That's extremely useful to be able to see that without having to bring the couch in or measure, you know, as everyone has to do. And I was thinking the education ramifications of this could be huge too. I mean, imagine being able to immerse kids into the lessons that they're learning, like history lessons, or like if they're building something, like they're building or they're examining something, like if they could examine like a car motor or something and have it blast apart and examine all the different pieces and see how it all works. Or even like Legos. I mean, you could have like examples where the Legos all blast apart and then come back together so you can kind of see exactly how you need to build something. I mean, like the possibilities are really exciting. And as you said, this is only just, maybe 100, 200 developers playing around with this, maybe more. We haven't seen what's possible when everyone is building stuff yet. I mean, this is just scratching the surface of what people are going to be able to do with this because there aren't that many people using it yet. So this could be something that turns into, and I said this last week, just a whole new computing paradigm. And I hate to say this, but it's going to happen eventually. And if you have kids that listen to this show, hit pause or skip ahead 30 seconds. Giving you an opportunity to protect their little ears. But once porn gets their hands on this, I mean, like, it's funny, but people in that industry always drive new technology. Is like when
they say. I think that's an old chestnut that I'm very skeptical about.
I think it makes a bit. Well, maybe that's too strong a word, but they definitely contribute to the adoption.
Well, they're
of
definitely
new
early adopters. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
I mean, Blu-ray and 4K and all this stuff. I mean, they're constantly looking for an angle, right, to sell people their product. I mean, and you can just think how you add virtual reality or augmented reality in. And it's gonna be like that scene in The Matrix, right, with the woman in the red the red dress. I mean, that's the kind of territory you might be talking about. And I'm sure it's only a matter of time before that stuff starts becoming available. So there's just gonna be a whole new Wild West world out there.
Actually, that's funny. I haven't seen any examples of that on this Twitter feed yet. I wonder if anyone is actually thinking about it.
Yeah,
don't search.
Don't search
well,
for
now
it.
Well, now you're curious. Hold on, I'll be right back.
I guarantee you, I'm not the first person who had considered that as a possibility.
Right,
I promise
that's very
you.
True,
I
yeah.
promise you that. You know, if there's money to be made, somebody will do it. All righty. Well, let's move on to this story of Slide to Unlock from Leander's hot future ebook. What's it called, Leander?
Unsung Apple Hero.
The Unsung Apple Hero.
The story of Baz Ording's career at Apple.
The saga of Baz Ording, Apple's greatest employee ever. You should have had me title this. Jeez.
Well, we had a big debate about that because we didn't want to like make it. He's a very humble guy, right? And he didn't want to make it sound. The whole time he was talking to me, he was apologizing for, you know, he didn't want to come across as though it was all his idea. You know, that he was taking credit for all this stuff, and he made it very clear that he was working with a team and there was a lot of other people involved, you know, and he heaped tons of praise on Steve Jobs, you know.
Yeah.
But he was very, very wary of that. And, you know, we had a big debate about the title, like, you know, like Unsung Apple Hero, you know, aren't we making a big, too big a deal out of this? You know, and aren't we singling him out? Aren't we going to like upset some of his colleagues? You know, because he's he's getting like all the blame. But you know, I mean, Lewis, chip in there. You were the one who was saying that it was well, it's true, and there's probably a bunch of unsung Apple heroes, and we can make it into a series.
Exactly,
which is actually what we're thinking about.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking about somebody who came up with these, you know, spent a lot of time coming up with these really pivotal things, and you know, I mean, who's heard of him? Prior to now,
I had heard his name, but I didn't know exactly who he was. I actually thought he was somebody else. I thought he was Bud. What's that guy's name? Bud, the guy who was flirting with Buster at that party, Leander.
Bud Tribble.
But I thought he was Bud Tribble. But Bud Tribble's a lot older, isn't he?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's start with this. Who is Baz Ording?
All right, so he was he's a Dutch UI designer. So he designs user interfaces, and he was hired personally by Steve Jobs right out of college back in 1997 or 1998.
Right out of college? Where did he go to college?
In the School of the Arts in Utrecht in Holland.
Wow.
So he came over like on a whim. He was you know, he was always interested in he was always obsessed, you know, I should say obsessed, not interested, obsessed with computer interfaces. And he had an early Mac, and he was really interested in designing, you know, with like buttons, sliders, you know, all the stuff that goes into computer UIs. He had an artistic bent, but he was also, you know, kind of technical too. So he had a math side to him. So he'd stay up all night designing these little buttons and doing all these different variations. This is one of the secrets to his success, you know, as a successful UI designer. Like he explores all the different possibilities, and he's very good at physics. You know, like he was really good at making these virtual objects act like real world objects. So he made a CD of these little demos, as he calls them, all these little buttons and sliders and. Critically, like, you know, he was interested in how you display a folder full of images. Mm-hmm. You know, back in those days, you'd open a folder and it'd have, you know, you'd see these icons for like photos. If it was a folder full of photos, you'd see an icon for a photo, but you wouldn't actually see the real photo. And so he was interested in how do you display the contents of a folder, you know, to a user to make it useful. And so he started playing around with effects, you know, so you slide your cursor over a picture and it would balloon up. It would blow up so you could see what it actually looked like. Then you'd slide over to the next one and it would blow up. And of course, like a lot of these effects became part of OS X.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm telling the whole story. But he came over with a demo, and he got a meeting through a contact at Apple with a human interface group, mm-hmm. and they were so impressed they showed it to Steve. And cut a long story short, Steve wouldn't let him leave the building without a contract. He already had a job somewhere else. He had a job at Meta Creations, which is down in Santa Barbara, and it was like, you know, California dream. They have an office right on the beach, and it was like Baywatch, wow. and he really wanted to go work down there. But Steve Jobs wouldn't let him. And then he went back to Holland, like, and Jobs pestered him for 2 weeks. And he got Johnny Ive and Scott Forstall to phone him up too.
Wow.
they were calling him up like, you know, day and night to try to get him to come work at Apple. Uh-huh. And eventually he did. And anyway, you know, cut long story short, they were working on the beta of OS X. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, OS X, the original plan was just to port over the old Mac OS. They were gonna undo the guts of the system. They were gonna base it on Next Step, you know, and BSD, you know, and with a Mac kernel. They were gonna like modernize the guts of it, but they were gonna make it basically look like the old Mac OS. Mm-hmm. And then they saw some of these, you know, some other people in the human interface group. They had all these ideas to make it look cool, add animations, the kind of stuff that Baz had been working on at college, and some of his colleagues too. So you know they worked for 2 years with Jobs, you know, to really make OS X into this really modern looking and really surprising, beautifully animated.
And they added some amazing stuff, didn't they? I mean, wasn't he responsible, at least partly, for the magnification aspect of the dock, which I love. That was one of the first things I fell in love with on the Mac.
Right. And so I've got this. He told me how he came up with that idea and how Jobs reacted to that and how that became part of OS X. And also, you know, he did Expose, which is, you know, when you see all that, when you can press that button and all the windows zoom out and
they're presented into a grid. One of the best UI features or interface features on a computer ever designed. I mean, it's so good that Windows copied it eventually.
Right, and the Genie effect as well. Mm-hmm. That was his one of the things he worked on. And he tells me how he came up with the ideas and how they implemented them and how they presented to Steve and how Steve made suggestions and made them better. So it's really fascinating. Like he was very candid, very open, and explained it really well. You know, like it was really clear how the ideas came to be. The thing I liked it, you know, was you really got into the mind of a designer, and it's not really that magical. You know, like once he explained how he thinks and what he does, you know, I was able to tease out this workflow that really is kind of logical, and I think has a lot of lessons for everybody, you know, who's in this field.
Are you going to be including those lessons in the book?
Oh, yeah. That's what the book's about.
Okay, so things that you can do to become a better interface designer and work at Apple and make millions.
Well, I think it applies to
You needed me to title this book, by the way. I mean, I've already thrown out three titles that would have made this thing get downloaded like a billion times.
Okay, well, we can brainstorm that. Okay. If anyone else has any suggestions, too, hit us up on Twitter.
Okay, so let's talk specifically then about the slide to unlock. That was that magical way to unlock your iPhone that was one of those iconic interface features of the first iPhone and many iterations after that. And it was very cool how they kind of came up with that mechanic. But I would first mention that I thought it was interesting that you pointed out that Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone as this really cool multi-touch device, but they realized very quickly that multi-touch wasn't going to work, and they pretty much threw that whole concept out the window.
Well, yes and no. You know, multi-touch obviously is like, you know, the screen technology that allows you to, the screen to detect multiple input points, you know, which allows things like pinching to zoom and, other, you know, more gestures, you know, like
complicated, gestures, more complicated gestures.
Yeah, using
say.
Three fingers to swipe or two fingers to swipe, you know. And but one of the problems was that, you know, they realized that people were going to be holding this phone with one hand. And a lot of the things like sliding to unlock, originally they wanted to do it like a door being unlocked or a lock being unlocked. They wanted to make it like a swiping motion, like a turning motion. So you'd use two fingers to turn a handle on the screen. But the trouble was you couldn't do that with one hand. Mm-hmm. And then they realized, you know, like extrapolating from that, they realized, well, a lot of the interactions were going to be one-handed on the phone. So they you know, even though they had this multi-touch technology and they'd invested so much time and energy in developing multi-touch, the realization was that most people are going to be using it one-handed, so they're going to have to make most of the gestures, the most important gestures, single point, you know, single touch gestures. So they wanted to use, like with a phone, it had a proximity sensor, and they thought, well, if people put it in their pockets, the proximity sensor will take care of turning off the screen so that they won't have any, you know, pocket dials or you know, deleting emails accidentally. But then when you pulled it out of your pocket, you know, your fingers would be touching the screen, or your finger would be touching the screen, and it would, you know, it would wake it up, and then you could accidentally start, you know, interacting with it. So they realized they had to lock the screen, and there had to be some kind of, you know, some kind of unlocking mechanism, intentional unlocking mechanism. And they were going to do a vertical one, but that was too easy to invoke. As you're pulling the phone from your pocket, it's a vertical motion,
right?
So it would be too easy to invoke that. So it had to be horizontal, you know. And then it had to be a swipe, and they wanted to make sure that people knew that they had to swipe across, all the way across.
Mm-hmm.
So they put slide to unlock, you know, those immortal words, slide to unlock, in there. But it was they wanted to show the direction, and so they were thinking about putting arrows in, but then it made it too busy. So then Baz had the idea of, well, maybe, but what if you shot on like a spotlight across,
like that
the letters.
Sheen that kind of glowed from left to right as you held it there.
Exactly, yeah. So that's how you get that. You know, you get that. It looks like it indicates the direction of movement by shining a light across the letters, mm-hmm. and it lights them up as it goes along.
It's those tiny little interactions that you don't even notice that they're there. But it probably took them countless hours to develop that idea to make it so natural that when you have your phone in your hand for the first time using a phone with technology that you've never seen before, you instinctively know how to use it. That's right. Amazing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, this is the genius of the thing, and this is, there's a ton of hard work. He gave me some other examples, you know, like a good one is the screen rotation. When you rotate the screen, and you can see this is especially true on the iPad, when you go from landscape to portrait and portrait to landscape and back again, if you look at it, you'll see that the icons rearrange themselves. Hmm. It's a different, it's like, you know, on the iPad, I think it's a grid of 5x4, anyway, it's 5 horizontally. If it's in landscape, it's 5 icons across the top, and then 4 rows. But if you put it into portrait, it's 4 across the top and then 5 columns, you know, 5 rows.
Right.
So if you look at this, he said that they animated really carefully. That it's a really complex animation when you turn your iPad from portrait to landscape. It's you know, multiple frames, and there are icons flying around everywhere. They, you know, there are icons that are flying off screen and icons flying on screen, because depending on which way you turn it, sometimes there are icons that come in from the second screen.
Mm-hmm.
But you would, I guarantee no one has ever noticed this. But he said it was a ton of work to get this to work right. And they actually animate a whole bunch of transition screens that you don't see, but if they weren't there, it would look jarring and weird.
Hmm.
And he said, if you don't have it, it looks totally strange. It's like it just looks really bad. You know, like there's no fluidity to it.
Mm-hmm,
there's just icons fly around everywhere, and then they find a new place, and it's totally jarring. So stuff like that, you know, like there was a whole bunch of things that they did, all this kind of work behind the scenes that you'd never ever notice. And this is what he said he loved about Apple, was this attention to their detail.
Yeah.
He said, you see it with other people's products. And, you know, like, you know, he's talking about Android, but he said, if you look at Android, it's like full of all this kind of stuff that they didn't do. They didn't put this kind of thought and attention to detail into, which makes it, you know, an inferior system.
And it's surprising too when you run across something like that and you're like, oh, this doesn't work very well with, I'm not talking about with iPhone, but like just with products in general. And I always think to myself, someone probably noticed that was a problem, or maybe they didn't. But if somebody did notice, they didn't care enough to fix it. They're just like, let's just leave it. Who cares? You know, it's good enough. Like it doesn't really work that well, but let's just go ahead and have the marketing team gloss over it and sell this product and let's get these units out the door. And that's something that Apple doesn't do, which is one of the reasons why, and I'm sure this is true for many of the people listening to this show, we love Apple so much, is because of their pursuit of excellence in all the things that they do and the amount of care and attention to detail that they put into all their products. It's just a rare thing, I feel like, in this world. Not a lot of companies are doing that.
Right. Absolutely.
Yep. He also invented, well, at least helped invent the bouncing effect, right? When you, or the rubber band effect, I should say, when you're scrolling and you run out of stuff to scroll, and it kind of like goes, stretches out and then bounces back into shape. And that was part of the lawsuit against Samsung, wasn't it? Didn't they try to copy that?
Yeah, and slide to unlock too. These were some of the iconic effects that Apple used to say, you know, like, look, these are good examples of all the work we put into developing the system and why we need to, you know, why we deserve the patents and it deserves to be protected. They used those examples of stuff that Samsung ripped off.
Yeah, and when you use another phone that doesn't have some of those features, you really notice, especially if you're coming from an iPhone, that some of that polish, like the rubber banding effect, isn't there. And And for me, it diminishes the experience. Gosh, that's such a snooty thing to say, but it's true. It's true.
Well, you know, we talked about the rubber band effect last week, and he said, you know, the first task he was given when they were exploring what to do with multi-touch technology by Steve Jobs himself was to build a list, a scrolling list, mm-hmm. and so he'd already done inertia effects. Like, he was big on doing inertia. Like, he'd love to have digital objects to have their own physics or to obey the laws of physics. So, you know, you'd hit the list and it would keep rolling, and that was good. Mm-hmm. But then when he got to the bottom, it would just stop. And if it just came to a dead stop, it would just sit there, and right. It was like, oh, is it still working or is it crashed? It looked like it had crashed. Uh-huh. And then if you tried to move it, it wouldn't do anything. So it really looked like it had crashed. So he was like, well, what if I put a bar in there, you know, like, to something to show, so it looks like it's, you know, this bar moves to show that something's happening, but all it did was repeat the problem. Mm-hmm. Like, the bar would just sit there. The bar wouldn't move. Like, a mm-hmm. bar would be revealed, but then it would just sit there and it wouldn't move. And he's like, well, it's got to move, and then it's got to move back. So, oh, it's got to sort of like have some give. Mm-hmm. So, and then he came across the idea of like it going backwards again. So it felt like a rubber band, and it was like, ah, okay, that's perfect, because it shows the user that you've reached the end of the list, and it indicates that the system hasn't crashed either.
I love geeking out about these little details, because, again, that is one of those, inertial scrolling particularly, is one of those magical UI effects that didn't exist before, and now it's ubiquitous and everyone wants to copy it, and it just seems like it's always existed, doesn't it? It's like,
right.
It's like, it's just always been there. It's such a natural occurrence in software.
Yeah, exactly. Natural. That's exactly the word. It's natural. It's like, they built in all this real world physics. You know, they behave like real objects. And this was like the big debate about skeuomorphism, which you also get into in the ebook. You know, they were using real world examples. They tried to make these digital objects like the real world. And that's what made it. And you know, it came under a lot of criticism. A lot of people were like very dismissive of it, you know, years later. But initially, when the phone came out, this is what made it intuitive. You know, this is what allowed you to pick it up and use it immediately without, you know, cracking a manual or being told how to use it, because it, you know, it behaved like the real world. It had its own, it obeyed the laws of physics.
And of course, it gives that Apple device, like all other Apple devices, that indescribable lust factor. You know, right. Where you feel like you're falling in love with the device.
Oh, yeah.
We've all experienced with our Apple devices at one time or another. Well, this story and more are going to be available in Leander's hot new ebook that's going to shoot up the charts in downloads. And you better get it while it's still available for free before he decides to charge $285 for every copy. But for right now, you can get it for the low, low price of free. Well, it's not out yet, so you can sign up to get it. I'll include the link in the show notes, and you can check out the story that we just spoke about, and you can also sign up to get the ebook, which will have undoubtedly even better stories than this one that we've just talked about, because Baz Ording has a 15-year tenure at Apple, so he has all sorts of stories to tell. And as Leander said earlier, or maybe we talked about this last week, it's extremely unusual to have this much access to someone who had this much influence at Apple. It's actually, I'm not even sure why he spoke to you, Leander. I really am not sure why he did.
Well, because I think a lot of these guys are a little bit frustrated. You know, they don't get the recognition that for all this historic work that they did. You know, they didn't get any recognition at all. And no one knows their names, you know, and they created these historic products. I mean, the iPhone is the most influential product of our era. You know, it's the motor car. It's the Ford Model T of the late 20th century, mm-hmm. right? It's or the 21st century. It's changed not only the cell phone industry, but a ton of other industries. Yeah. It has given birth to all these kind of unimaginable society changing technologies like Uber. You know, Uber is transforming transportation, and it wouldn't have happened without the iPhone. Snapchat, Facebook, you know, you name it. Our lives have been completely transformed. The world has been completely transformed by this, you know, and the way they came up with it is an untold story. You know, Walter Isaacson's book about Jobs, you know, was a monumental work and in its own right, but its huge failing was that it didn't get into his work at Apple. Hmm. Right? It hardly talked about it at all. It hardly talked about how they came up with these products. There's one short chapter on the iPhone, and it sort of glosses over, you know, like, you know, it doesn't really say how they came up with this stuff. And now these people are starting to talk, you know, like a lot of them have left Apple, and they feel as though that, you know, that there's a historical story to be told. And so, you know, actually I've contacted some of the other team members, Greg Christie, Imran Chowdhury, and some others, you know, and I'm hoping to be able to get to talk to those guys as well in the future. So hopefully this story will get a little more rounded out. You know, my ambition is to do something like Andy Hertzfeld's Folklore. Do you remember, do you know that site? Do you remember that?
No.
When they talked to, it's at folklore.org. And Andy Hertzfeld was one of the software designers of the original Mac. And so his site, which is a good, you know, 15 years old by now, or maybe even longer, you know, he got a lot of the members of the original Mac team to tell their stories. And it was all organized into a website called at folklore.org, and then eventually a book that was published by O'Reilly. But it was all these, like, you know, sort of the stories from the troops themselves, you know, from the people who developed the original Macintosh. And it was a lot of stuff about, you know, all of their struggles with the hardware and the software and working with Steve Jobs and flying the pirate flag, you know, at their little headquarters, like outside of Apple. And it's, you know, it's a great resource because it tells, like, it's like an oral history. It's like a really great, rich oral history of the development of the original Mac. And, you know, that's my ambition for the, for this project, you know, is to get to talk to some of these guys and tell the similar stories about the iPhone and the iPad and all the work they did at Apple under Steve Jobs that was kept very carefully under wraps. You know, because of his secrecy, he'd often do a shout-out, you know, like at the end of all the keynotes, he'd like to, you know, he'd say, hey, can everyone stand up and give a round of applause to the, you know, to the great Apple team and everybody's
these guys have been working on this project for 10 years.
Yeah, right. But no one ever got named, you know, and, yeah. And Steve got all the credit, and he deserves a lot of credit, you know, like Apple wouldn't have been Apple without him, and these products wouldn't have been these products without him. He was like a very, very active, engaged member of the team. But, you know, he tended to get all the credit. And I think in the popular imagination, you know, it's like, oh yeah, Steve Jobs invented the iPhone. Steve Jobs invented the iPod. But, you know, the truth is it was invented by, you know, a big team of people. And that the interesting thing, I think, is all the problems and the challenges and where the ideas came from. Hmm. And there's a ton of lessons there, I think, for a lot of people, as well as just being an interesting story. I think there's lessons in how to do things. You know, Apple has been the most successful company. You know, it's the world's biggest company, isn't it? So by definition, you know, it's probably the most successful company in the world right now. But how they work is a complete mystery, and you know, and I think fascinating. And there's a lot of lessons there for everybody.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really kind of the cream, is how these guys were able to accomplish what they accomplished, what their workflows are like, what their attitudes are, how they think. Like that's the really fascinating stuff behind all these stories is maybe you could glean some skills for yourself to help yourself become like a better UI designer or whatever it is you're doing.
Whatever you're doing. Yeah. I mean, there's actually a really good book about Pixar that came out. I think it was earlier this year or maybe last year by the ex CFO of Pixar, and I interviewed him for the other, you know, for the Kane's Corner podcast, mm-hmm. Lawrence Levy, and he his book is called To Pixar and Beyond, and you know, like it was about how he came to Pixar. And it was in disarray. You know, the company was really, really in trouble. It was a disaster, really. And Steve Jobs, you know, they really didn't know what they were doing. They were floundering around. And the story he tells in the book is how they piece it together and how Jobs, he and Jobs and the other members of the team there, you know, when they were coming up with Toy Story, how they put all these pieces into place for Pixar to be a success and then go on to this, like, you know, this amazing run of putting out one blockbuster after another for a good decade or so. And then eventually they got bought by Disney. But you know, what I found really fascinating in that book is that there's nothing really magical in there at all. Hmm. All they did was they had all these problems and they carefully analyzed them, and you know they would just work them out step by step, and it's a really intimate portrait of Jobs at work, and the picture you get back is that he wasn't, you know, he was intelligent, but he wasn't anything really special. Mm-hmm. He was a genius, you know, like in some ways he was a genius, but like, and when he was confronted by these particular problems at Pixar, you know, the solutions they came up with were the kind of solutions that any intelligent person would come up with. And the magic was just like, you know, was being able to look at their problems, look at the situations they were faced with, you know, map them out and come up with a strategy for solving them. And, you know, what I got was an impression of a company run by intelligent people who would meet, discuss their problems, figure out what to do, you know, put their plans into action, and lo and behold, they were successful.
Yeah, but lots of companies do that, and they end up with a big pile of crap, and they end up going bankrupt. And Steve Jobs was able to build one successful company after another. And so I really I really like that angle of examining Steve Jobs and getting an intimate portrait of how he thought and how he would assemble his teams and how he would solve these problems, because clearly he was doing something that the other people were not doing. And he was able to replicate it. He did it at Apple. He did it at Next. He did it at Pixar. And all three of these companies were extremely successful. So he had some way of approaching these problems that allowed him to solve them in a way that led to great success.
Well, right, but I don't think there's anything mythical about it. I don't think there's anything magical about it. You know, it was just that he was engaged.
Hmm. You think it simply comes down to that?
Well, you know, I think there were definitely some, you know, there are definitely aspects of his personality, right? He's very driven.
Yeah.
He's also kind of a little bit sociopathic. He would use people as tools, you know, to get his goals achieved. I think one of the things that Baz said that in his view was the most important was that once Steve had made a decision, he would have the force of personality to get it done. Hmm. It's like they would go to a meeting, they would agree, they would discuss something. He wouldn't always come up with it. Sometimes he'd come up with really daft ideas and he would get voted down, right? You know, mm-hmm. everyone would say, no, that's ridiculous. You can't do that. But they would come to a decision at the end of the meeting, and he said that once the decision had been made, it was going to be implemented, right? Because Steve wanted it. And he had that first force of personality. So like with them, you know, like if Steve told them to do something, you know, to change something, he expected to see that change the next time, the next week. Hmm. And if he didn't do it, he would raise hell, mm-hmm. you know? And so like, that was the thing, you know, like, and I think this is the lesson also like from my Johnny Ive book, like talking to the members of the design team, the same thing happened with design, you know, like he wanted to elevate design, industrial design to be at the very heart of Apple, to make industrial design be the, you know, the way they did things by working things out in the industrial design studio. And, you know, before he came back, design was like an afterthought. You know, the marketers, the salespeople and the engineers would come up with the products at Apple. It would be driven by engineering and by marketing. And they'd have these huge lists of all these things they need to tick off. And then the products they designed would get past the industrial design team to put a nice box around it. And he thought that was backwards. He thought that the industrial design team should be working out how these things work in the most mm-hmm. fundamental way possible. Mm-hmm. And then the engineers should be working for the designers and the marketers should be working for the designers. You know what I mean? So they design these nice products and then these other teams get brought in. You know, engineering gets brought in afterwards to figure out how to make it and marketing gets brought in afterwards to figure out how to market it. You know, so they have some input, but they're not the ones who are driving it. And there's a famous you know, video of him talking about this, like what went wrong with Microsoft, you know, talking about, and he said, well, what happened with Microsoft is that the salespeople took over. It became a sales organization, mm-hmm. you know, and the priorities of the company changed from it being, you know, driven from being a product company into being a marketing company. Anyway, mm-hmm. so, you know, the thing, this is what, you know, this is what the design team feel his influence was. Jobs' most important contribution was making Apple design-led, you mm-hmm. know, and it was the force of, he was able to, they wouldn't have been able to do it without him. They needed someone like a CEO like Steve Jobs to change that company, and it took a good 10 years for this to happen. Wow. But, you know, because he wanted it, he was able to force it through. So, you know, getting back to that original point, yeah, you know, like he is forceful, and this is what you need to be a CEO, you know, this is why I think a lot of companies, this is something that he brings as a CEO, you know, like his special talents that not everyone can replicate. You know, because how many people in an organization could say, okay, this is how, you know, we're going to do it this, you know, I'm going to make sure that everyone obeys what I say.
Right.
You know, it's very, very difficult. He's in a privileged position to do that. So there aren't lessons for everybody there, you know. But I think what I liked about it was the myth busting. You know, this idea, I think that Jobs was this lone genius who had these amazing technological visions. And, you know, the companies that he worked, that he built, implemented them. And I think the truth is, you know, much more layered and much more interesting. And that he was like, you know, the picture I get is that he was working with teams of talented people. One of his famous quotes is saying, you know, you don't hire smart people and tell them what to do.
Right.
You know, that's stupid. They tell you what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very, very true. You know, he would get these teams. Like if you look at his career, you know, time and time again, he's working with teams of people and they would come up with, it's an anathema because people hate this, but they would come up, they were committee-driven decisions. They were committees, you know, like all the decisions they made were made by a committee, mm-hmm. which a lot of people think is death because it tends to water stuff down. But they would come to a, you know, they would agree on these things. And then, you know, he would be the implementer, the enforcer, the one who made sure that whatever decision they come up with got implemented.
Some of these stories are also in your Johnny I books, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got so many books. How many should we pimp out here today?
Yeah, well, that was one of the, you know, I think the themes of the Johnny I book too was this kind of thing, you know, this kind of workflow.
Yeah, I find this stuff to be fascinating, especially the inner workings of Steve Jobs' mind. What was the name of that Pixar book again, in case people wanted to check that out? That wasn't yours, but...
Yeah, To Pixar and Beyond.
To Pixar and Beyond.
I did an hour-long interview with Levy where we talked about some of these things that I think was, you know, turned out really well. I really liked the interview, and he's a very thoughtful guy and very articulate, and it's a great book. I think it's a really fascinating book. It's one of the best books I've read about Apple or Steve Jobs.
Oh, really?
I think it's the best book, in fact. The other ones are bullshit. I mean, like, they really are, including my own.
Especially my own. Let me just tell you.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, like... Yeah, including my own, I got to admit.
No, you're being too hard on yourself.
It's not. Well, you know, like I was working, there was a lot of this stuff hadn't come out, you know, when I wrote that book, you know, and it was, Apple's very, very secretive and people were really scared, you know, like every one time you talk to someone, they're very skeptical. They don't want to talk to a journalist, you know, they've signed a big stack of NDAs.
Right.
And they're terrified of getting sued. And Apple's very good at keeping the lids on that stuff. But, you know, like, I think, you know, there's also a precedent of a lot of people, who do talk eventually about what happened and how things got made. You know, like the whole Macintosh team has talked about the early Macintosh. No one ever got into any legal trouble with Apple. And now the iPhone team is starting to talk about how the iPhone came together. And people like Tony Fadell and John Rubenstein, they've been talking their whole careers. You know, the reason they're famous is because they've been talking to the media. Mm. And some of them, I think, have been getting a lot of the credit, you know, for other, you know, they've been taking a lot of the credit that maybe they don't, you know, should be shared out a little more.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and they're not really giving any, like, terribly huge secrets either. You know, they're telling, you know, that I think some of the stuff Apple wants to guard, you know, like a lot of the procedural stuff. Mm-hmm. Like they have this thing called the ANPP, the Apple New Product Process, which is this gigantic system for working out how new products will be made. Hmm. And implemented in the company. And it's like a giant checklist, basically. And it extends all the way from, you know, to how these things are manufactured, to all the suppliers, what kind of screws they're going to use, what kind of paint they're going to use, where the paint comes from, you know, who's the secondary source for the paint, or the third source for the paint, the fourth source for the paint, how this stuff is going to get transported, you know, from one supplier to another. It's an incredibly complex system.
It's like the Apple Bible.
Right.
The entire manufacturing process and design process.
Oh, yeah. And it also extends into how stuff is repaired. Mm-hmm. You know, they think about repairs and they think about people bringing them to the Genius store, you know, years later, and how this stuff is going to get repaired, what kind of supplies they need, what kind of design decisions they have to be made to make sure that technicians can take these things apart and repair them quickly.
It's unbelievably complicated. Yeah. Right.
And they don't want to, you know, they don't want to dig into that because this is, I think, this is an industrial secret.
Yeah.
You know, and it's also like how they work in the factories, how they structure their teams. You know, one of the things is they have KPI?
I'm
key
not
person
sure.
of, you know, there's, Jobs has talked a little bit about this, like how there's one person in charge of a product or a division or a, you know, whatever it is. There's a key person whose responsibility it is for one particular thing. Hmm. And this, I think, is, you know, the other companies haven't adopted yet, or you know, they have a different structure. But this is one of the things, like that kind of stuff, you know, like the very nitty gritty stuff about exactly how Apple is organized, how people work. That's the kind of stuff they don't want to talk about because that stuff is an industrial secret.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll link to the ebook. I'll link to your Johnny Ive book. Is there anything else? I feel like we talked about. We just went through like 10 different books.
Well, I'll send you a link to the stuff I did for Lawrence Levy.
Okay.
So the podcast, and I wrote a couple of stories about him too.
Oh, perfect, perfect. Okay, yeah, great. So I'll link to all this stuff in the show notes for everyone who wants to check this stuff out more. We're going long, but let's go ahead and wrap up with an all new. Under review, we talk about the apps and technology that we're currently checking out. I wish Buster were here for this episode. He's on vacation, but I'm going to be pimping something that is drone related for all those people that get incredibly angry when we talk about drones. You might want to skip over it so that you don't go full on Hulk and start bashing things around your office. Lander, do you want to go first? I think I went first last time.
Okay, sure.
What do you got?
I feel like
for
I've been
us?
Doing a lot of talking, but whatever.
this episode? No. No, right. I've been leading you on because I find this stuff to be interesting. So I've been trying to get you going. And once I get you started on Steve Jobs, it's like I just kick back and I just relax.
Okay.
Smoke the stogie.
All right. So what I've been reviewing is a keyboard, a new keyboard. It's a mechanical keyboard.
Oh man.
I've always had a problem with touch typing. Like I can't really touch type on a computer keyboard, but I can touch type on an old typewriter keyboard. This thing is like a mechanical keyboard that's based on, like, they call it the first mechanical keyboard that resembles a typewriter keyboard.
Oh, yeah. I think I've seen this thing online.
Yeah, it's called the Lo-Free. Here, let me give an example. Here, ready? Tune in. Yeah. Listen to how it works.
Oh, lovely. Music to my ears, actually. That's great.
So it's actually really great.
What's the name of the brand or the keyboard?
Lo-Free. L-O-Free. Lo-Free.
Okay, got it.
And it was a Kickstarter project, and they wanted to raise like $10,000, and they got inundated. They raised hundreds of thousands.
Really?
And it was. I've backed a couple of Kickstarter projects, and I haven't always had a ton of luck, with getting what I wanted. This thing came in like about 2 weeks after I backed it, and I paid $79, and it's normally $129, and I'm not really sure what is the.
Oh wow! This thing actually looks pretty good.
Yeah, it's nice. It really is.
I thought you were talking about something else. I've seen some other keyboards that are mechanical that resemble this that look hideous. Hideous. And I thought that's what you're trying to pitch us here, but this thing actually looks cool.
No, and I'm afraid it's gone up to $129 now. So,
bummer.
And it's like they're saying estimated August delivery. That stinks.
Well, mechanical keyboards are never cheap. I mean, that's
this thing's really hefty. It's actually a Bluetooth keyboard, but it can also be a wired keyboard.
Yeah.
But and it's got a really nice backlight, so that all the keys light up, and it looks really good at nighttime.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. They got different colors available.
Right, and yeah, exactly. It's several different colors. They also get, you have some spare keys, so you can change the layout of the keyboard. There's a little button on the side, so you can configure it for Mac and iOS or Windows and Android. So it changes, and they give you some spare keys to change the actual, what's on the keys.
Nice.
It has all the function keys at the top, all the stuff you're used to, so it'll invoke mission control, and expose, lights up and down, sound up and down. It's really good. The only thing I don't like about it is the shift key on the right. Like the keyboard layout is a little bit different to the Apple keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a lot of muscle memory and you're used to typing on the Apple keyboard, if you transfer to this, it's going to be a nightmare because you're going to start hitting the up and down key instead of the shift key.
Oh, I see what you mean, because the shift keys on the left and the right hand side are not in the same row.
Right. Exactly. They're not in the same. Yeah. So exactly. So I keep on hitting the up key when I mean to hit shift, and then I start typing, and it starts putting stuff in the line above. Yeah, it's a little bit frustrating. And also the number buttons are also slightly in a different position. Like they're on the Apple keyboard, they're shifted to the right.
Yeah.
And this keyboard, they're shifted over to the left. So there's a little bit of, if you're a touch typist and you use your Apple keyboard, I think it's going to be frustrating.
Well, there's going to be a learning curve for sure. Right. I mean, but that happens anytime you you move to a different keyboard. All right, so the Lo-Free keyboard, it's $129. I'll link to it in the show notes, of course. I'll go next because I think yours is going to be the most exciting here, Lewis. So I am reviewing some polarizing and neutral density filters from Polar Pro, and they work with the DJI Phantom 4 Pro, but they have them available for other drones as well. And they're useful in two ways. First, the polarizing filters reduce the amount of light that hit your sensor, and they also eliminate glare. So if you are flying over like a river or you're flying over like cars, you can adjust the filters so that the glare is taken out of the windows or the water, and it shows you just pure water or the cars without those nasty sunspots reflecting off them. And so it just gives you a much nicer, cleaner picture. It's also particularly effective when you're flying over trees, because like the green leaves of trees reflect sunlight. And so a polarizing filter will allow you to see what's on the ground when you're flying without all of these nasty sunspots reflecting off whatever you're flying over. So it's useful in that regard. But also, the neutral density filters allow you to reduce the amount of light that hits your lens, And it allows you to have more freedom to move around your shutter speed, your aperture speed. That can be really important if you live in a sunny place. Like I was flying my drone in Florida some weeks ago, and I was flying over these white sand beaches with the ocean below. And dude, Florida, if you've never been there, it's like living on the sun. It is so freaking bright there. It's totally different from Seattle. It's so bright that you can barely open your eyes in the middle of the day without having sunglasses on. And so that's what these filters are. They're like sunglasses for your camera, for your DJI video camera, and they give you a much more a clean image, a much more saturated image. They make your video footage look much more beautiful, and then they allow you to adjust your frame rates and your shutter and your aperture to have a much more cinematic recording, so that your film or your video recording looks more like it does in the movies if you adjust it correctly. So it just gives you a lot more freedom with your video settings, and I highly recommend them to everyone who has a drone. I think that they're useful in virtually all flying scenarios. You can buy a pack of three.
What do you want, a pack of three or four?
Well, they come in different levels. So there are polarizing filters that reduce like one stop of light. There are polarizing filters that reduce 16 stops of light. And a stop of light in camera terminology is a measure of how much light is being let into the lens, and you can reduce them by adjusting the aperture and the shutter. And this is just another way to reduce how much light enters the lens. So they sell them in various packs. I received the Shutter Collection and the Vivid Collection, which include different assortments of neutral density filters and polarizing filters. Each pack contains three different filters, and they're $100 each, which is actually not bad. I have single filters for my regular photography equipment that cost like $150 each. So getting a pack of three for $100 is actually not a bad deal at all. I'll link to these in the show notes. I know these aren't for everyone because there are people out there that don't have drones or aren't really interested in photography, but I would say if you are interested in photography and you don't have a drone, a polarizing filter is one of those critical pieces of camera gear that can really help you and totally change the way you approach photography because they're so useful. So that's what I've been checking out, the Polar Pro Vivid Collection and Shutter Collection, the neutral density and polarizing filters. Okay, Lewis, bring us home here, man. This is the longest show I think we've ever done, but let's just keep it going.
Let's just
keep it going until the wheels fall off. I need you to talk about this for at least the next hour and a half. Here we go.
Okay, I'll talk very slowly. That'll help.
Yeah, definitely talk slow and try not to change the pitch of your voice, okay?
Very slowly.
What do you got for us?
So I've been using the 10.5-inch iPad Pro, and I say using, I mean... Like I almost can't put this thing down. I love it. I use it for tons of things and way more than I've ever used an iPad. I mean, okay, I came off of like a iPad 4. I keep getting my wife's hand-me-downs.
Oh, you were on an iPad 4? Leander was telling us you were on the first one.
No, it wasn't that bad. But it the difference is it's like I compare it to like riding a moped and then getting on a Harley or something. I mean, it's like it's got so much power and it's just so unbelievably fun to use this thing. It looks great. It feels great. I mean, one of the most shocking things, and this is, doesn't really affect the way that you use it or anything, but I think it explains a lot about it. When you download an app, like an update an app, you see the little circle go around. Okay, well, that's pretty much the same as it is with my other devices, but when it's done, boom, it's installed. It's so fast. It's almost unbelievable how fast it is.
What are some of your favorite features about it so far?
I think the speed is the thing. I mean, I love the way it looks and I love the way it feels and I love not ever having to wait for anything. It totally handles the multitasking stuff beautifully. I mean, I never had a chance to use Slide Over before, you know, the older thing. And it's like, wow, this device is fantastic. I use it at home in my home office a lot, where I'm like responding to email or responding to, chats in Slack. I use the voice recognition in it, and it's great. I mean, everybody has an iPhone. I mean, you have voice recognition at your disposal, but there's just something great about being able to use this thing and have it be so responsive and so just. It's like everything's perfect, you know. I mean, I've never experienced quite this much magic, and I think it all has to do just with the speed. And I've only scratched the surface of what this thing can do. I mean, my wife has an Apple Pencil that I've, you know, messed around with a little bit. That's not really even what I'm not really into that, man. I'm not an artist, yeah. But you know, maybe it's crazy. Maybe I'm using like a shotgun to. You know, where I should use a pea shooter. I don't know. I mean, but to me, it feels super luxurious having this thing. And I mean, like I said, I've been carrying around an iPad, or I've had an iPad for a few years, but I've never had one that I take this thing to work every single day. I've never done that before. And I do it because it's just such a joy to use. I know I'm gushing over it, you know. And maybe I'm not saying much.
Lewis, you're complete. You're like a cyborg.
I am.
Man and machine melded into one.
Resistance is futile.
I just, and the other thing is, like, I've got this thing in a keyboard cover, but to be honest, I barely use the keyboard. I mean, why would I want to? The voice recognition is so fast. When you're typing on the screen, it's so fast. Everything it's the first time I've actually felt like, here's a tablet that doesn't need a keyboard. Here's a tablet that just does exactly what you're expecting and hoping for. Looking at photographs, you know, they load and they're so beautiful on this screen. I don't know. I honestly haven't been this excited about a product in a long time. I mean, I use it far more than I do the MacBook now. And
wow.
I just love it. I don't know what else to say. I love it.
I can tell.
Well, there was this big debate, wasn't there, last week, you know, about can the iPad replace your MacBook? Did you see that?
Yeah, I mean, people are always talking about that, right?
And they have that debate every time they release a new iPad.
And Charlie's making the case that he thinks it is with iOS 11, which I'm not even running that, you know. But there's still things that are not as easy. And I don't know how they could ever make it so that every single thing works better. But I mean, the reality is that most of the things that I do are actually easier. Now, if only the WordPress app would quit crashing. That's the one thing I can't do. I can't actually edit anything because every time I open it, our WordPress app crashes. So
and you're not actually running iOS 11 on it either, are you?
No. I've got a stable version of, 10.3.
Yeah,
I mean, even just like pressing to have Siri pop up, you know, one of the big problems I've had with the iPhone and Siri in general is this lag. And you compare it to like the Amazon Echo. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Echo is instantaneous, and that's what you want, right? You don't want to be sitting around waiting for something. And, I see my wife, like, now even Amazon Echo is a little bit too slow for her now, because she, like, you know, Alexa, wow, just give it half a second to recognize that you're talking to it.
It doesn't need it, though. That's the amazing part, is it still gets it.
She can actually, she can confuse it. But anyway, my point is that with this iPad Pro, if Siri is, like, instantaneously on, it's... Huh. I don't know.
This gives me hope for the HomePod, that it's going to be instantaneous like that, because that's actually going to be what it needs to be in order for me to, you know, really fall in love with it and actually use Siri on it. Yeah. You're making it hard for me, Lewis. I keep trying to tell myself every day. I'm like, I don't need an iPad. I don't need an iPad. I don't need an iPad. I've got an iPad. It works well enough for what I use it for. But, you know, I said this when the iPad reviews first started coming out, and it sounds like an obvious statement, but this really is the best iPad Apple's ever made. It's an exciting product, and the iPad hasn't been exciting in a long time.
That's exactly right. And you know, I was in that exact same experience. Like, well, I don't really need a new iPad. I don't really need it. My God, I love it. It's I don't get all excited about technology, you know, to the point where I'm like telling everybody about it. But I was showing it to somebody on the 4th of July. You know, here's a guy, he doesn't even have a smartphone, this guy. He's a guy who used to use voice recognition way back in the day when both of us did, 30 years ago, 25 years ago. We had to, you know, say one word at a time. And I mean, and you know, and it was like a, you know, thousands of dollars proposition. I showed him this thing, and he was just shocked because, you know, we're sitting there. I popped open the thing and we started talking into I don't know, notes or something. And you know, like I would talk, I would say a few words, he would say a few words. It recognized everything beautifully. It's all right there. And I felt like I was showing, you know, somebody some kind of alien technology.
You're not sleeping with the iPad at night, are you?
No, I charge it at night.
Yeah, is that what you're calling it? Okay. All righty, well, there you have it. We'll include show notes to everything that we've talked about, of course. And this show is now 16 hours long, so I think we should go ahead and wrap it up there. That's all the cult casts we have for you guys this week. But if you want to come say hi to us, we are on Twitter. Leander is L. Caney. I'm at Erfon, E-R-F-O-N. Lewis, are you at Lewis Wallace?
That is correct, sir.
Oh, boom! This has been the CultCast, the best 30++ minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the CultCast come out every Thursday night. I want to thank everyone for listening. Is there anyone still here? Is there anyone left? We got a few left.
I know, this is like the end of Ferris Bueller, isn't it?
Thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys next time. I'm gonna split this episode in half and release half this week and half next week. Right. Jeez.
Tack on the Wired UK one at the end.
Oh, yeah. And then there's that. And then there's that. Jeez.
You know, before this all started, the recording sounded fine on the QuickTime.
Okay. What'd you say, Leander?
Nothing. What's going on? Is it working?
I think so. We're just trying to get his audio going and working and heard.
Seems like it's fine. It's just, you know, I've never done this on this machine before.
Oh, right. You had a horrible PC.
Yeah. I could switch back to that if it makes you feel better.
Are you actually on a PC right now?
Right now?
Yeah.
You mean like this very moment?
Yeah.
No, it's a Mac.
Oh, you're on a Mac. Okay, good.
But I have a PC in the same room.
Well, that's okay as long as you don't touch it or make eye contact with it.
Right.
What version of Windows is it running, Lewis? Dare I ask?
95.
Heck yeah, that was a classic. Why change?
Are you kidding me? 95?
Just kidding. 10.
XP.